This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Made to Stick, Why Some Ideas Survive and Others Die, by Chip Heath and Dan Heath. Read for you by Charles Collenberg. Introduction. What sticks? A friend of a friend of ours is a frequent business traveler. Let's call him Dave. Dave was recently in Atlantic City for an important meeting with clients. Afterward, he had some time to kill before his flight, so he went to a local bar for a drink. He just finished one drink when an attractive woman approached and asked if she could buy him another. He was surprised, but flattered. "Sure," he said. The woman walked to the bar and brought back two more drinks, one for her and one for him. He thanked her and took a sip. And that was the last thing he remembered. Rather, that was the last thing he remembered until he woke up, disoriented, lying in a hotel bathtub, his body submerged in ice. He looked around frantically, trying to figure out where he was and how he got there. Then he spotted the note. "Don't move. Call 911. A cell phone rested on a small table beside the bathtub. He picked it up and called 911, his fingers numb and clumsy from the ice. The operator seemed oddly familiar with this situation. She said, "Sir, I want you to reach behind you, slowly and carefully. Is there a tube protruding from your lower back?" Anxious, he felt around behind him. Sure enough, there was a tube. The operator said, "Sir, don't panic, but one of your kidneys has been harvested. There's a ring of organ thieves operating in this city, and they got to you. Paramedics are on their way. Don't move until they arrive." You've just read one of the most successful urban legends of the past 15 years. The first clue is the classic urban legend opening, a friend of a friend. Have you ever noticed that our friends' friends have much more interesting lives than our friends themselves? You've probably heard the kidney heist tale before. There are hundreds of versions in circulation, and all of them share a core of three elements. Number one, the drugged drink. Number two, the ice-filled bathtub. And number three, the kidney theft punchline. One version features a married man who receives the drugged drink from a prostitute he has invited to his room in Las Vegas. It's a morality play with kidneys. Imagine that you closed the book right now, took an hour-long break, then called a friend and told the story without rereading it. Chances are you could tell it almost perfectly. You might forget that the traveler was in Atlantic City for an important meeting with clients. Who cares about that? But you'd remember all the important stuff. The kidney heist is a story that sticks. We understand it, we remember it, and we can retell it later. And if we believe it's true, it might change our behavior permanently, at least in terms of accepting drinks from attractive strangers. Contrast the kidney heist story with this passage, drawn from a paper distributed by a nonprofit organization. Comprehensive community building naturally lends itself to a return on investment rationale that can be modeled drawing on existing practice, it begins. Going on to argue that a factor constraining the flow of resources to CCIs is that funders must often resort to targeting or categorical requirements in grant making to ensure accountability. Imagine that you closed the book right now and took an hour-long break. In fact, don't even take a break. Just call up a friend and retell that passage without rereading it. Good luck. Is this a fair comparison? An urban legend to a cherry-picked bad passage? Of course not. But here's where things get interesting. Think of our two examples as two poles on a spectrum of memorability. Which sounds closer to the communications you encounter at work? If you're like most people, your workplace gravitates towards the nonprofit pole, as though it were the North Star. Maybe this is perfectly natural. Some ideas are inherently interesting, and some are inherently uninteresting. A gang of organ thieves, inherently interesting. Nonprofit financial strategy, inherently uninteresting. It's the nature versus nurture debate applied to ideas. Are ideas born interesting or made interesting? Well, this is a nurture book. So how do we nurture our ideas so they'll succeed in the world? Many of us struggle with how to communicate ideas effectively, how to get our ideas to make a difference. A biology teacher spends an hour explaining mitosis, and a week later, only 3 kids remember what it is. A manager makes a speech unveiling a new strategy as the staffers nod their heads enthusiastically. And the next day, the frontline employees are observed cheerfully implementing the old one. Good ideas often have a hard time succeeding in the world. Yet the ridiculous kidney heist tale keeps circulating, with no resources whatsoever to support it. Why? Is it simply because hijacked kidneys sell better than other topics? Or is it possible to make a true, worthwhile idea circulate as effectively as this false idea? The truth about movie popcorn. Art Silverman stared at a bag of movie popcorn. It looked out of place sitting on his desk. His office had long since filled up with fake butter fumes. Silverman knew, because of his organization's research, that the popcorn on his desk was unhealthy. Shockingly unhealthy, in fact. His job was to figure out a way to communicate this message to the unsuspecting moviegoers of America. Silverman worked for the Center for Science and Public Interest, CSPI, a nonprofit group that educates the public about nutrition. The CSPI sent bags of movie popcorn from a dozen theaters in 3 major cities to a lab for a nutritional analysis. The results surprised everyone. The United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, recommends that a normal diet contain no more than 20 grams of saturated fat each day. According to the lab results, the typical bag of popcorn had 37 grams. The culprit was coconut oil, which theaters used to pop their popcorn. Coconut oil had some big advantages over other oils. It gave the popcorn a nice silky texture and released a more pleasant and natural aroma than the alternative oils. Unfortunately, as the lab results showed, coconut oil was also brimming with saturated fat. The single serving of popcorn on Silverman's desk, a snack someone might scarf down between meals, had nearly 2 days' worth of saturated fat. And those 37 grams of saturated fat were packed into a medium-sized serving of popcorn. No doubt a decent-sized bucket could have cleared triple digits. The challenge, Silverman realized, was that few people know what 37 grams of saturated fat means. Most of us don't memorize the USDA's daily nutrition recommendations. Is 37 grams good or bad? And even if we have an intuition that it's bad, we'd wonder if it was bad-bad, like cigarettes, or normal-bad, like a cookie or a milkshake. Even the phrase 37 grams of saturated fat by itself was enough to cause most people's eyes to glaze over. Saturated fat has zero appeal, Silverman says. It's dry, it's academic, who cares? Silverman could have created some kind of visual comparison, perhaps an advertisement comparing the amount of saturated fat in the popcorn with the USDA's recommended daily allowance. Think of a bar graph with one of the bars stretching twice as high as the other. But that was too scientific somehow, too rational. The amount of fat in this popcorn was in some sense not rational, it was ludicrous. The CSPI needed a way to shape the message in a way that fully communicated this ludicrousness. Silverman came up with a solution. CSPI called a press conference on September 27, 1992. Here's the message it presented. A medium-sized butter popcorn at a typical neighborhood movie theater contains more artery-clogging fat than a bacon and eggs breakfast, a Big Mac and fries for lunch, and a steak dinner with all the trimmings combined. The folks at CSPI didn't neglect the visuals. They laid out the full buffet of greasy food for the television cameras, an entire day's worth of unhealthy eating displayed on a table, all that saturated fat stuffed into a single bag of popcorn. The story was an immediate sensation, featured on CBS, NBC, ABC, and CNN. It made the front pages of USA Today, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post's style section. Leno and Letterman cracked jokes about fat-soaked popcorn, and headline writers trotted out some doozies. Popcorn gets an R rating. Lights, action, cholesterol. Theater popcorn is double feature of fat. The idea stuck. Moviegoers, repulsed by these findings, avoided popcorn in droves. Sales plunged. The service staff at movie houses grew accustomed to fielding questions about whether the popcorn was popped in the bad oil. Soon after, most of the nation's biggest theater chains, including United Artists, AMC, and Lowe's, announced that they would stop using coconut oil. On stickiness. This is an idea success story. Even better, it's a truthful idea success story. The people at CSPI knew something about the world that they needed to share. They figured out a way to communicate the idea so that people would listen and care. And the idea stuck, just like the kidney heist tale. And let's be honest. The odds were stacked against the CSPI. The movie Popcorn is Fatty story lacks the lurid appeal of an organ-thieving gang. No one woke up in an oil-filled bathtub. The story wasn't sensational, and it wasn't even particularly entertaining. Furthermore, there was no natural constituency for the news. Few of us make an effort to stay up to date with popcorn news. There were no celebrities, models, or adorable pets involved. In short, the popcorn idea was a lot like the ideas that most of us traffic in every day. Ideas that are interesting but not sensational, truthful but not mind-blowing, important but not life or death. Unless you're in advertising or public relations, you probably don't have many resources to back your ideas. You don't have a multi-million-dollar ad budget or a team of professional spinners. Your ideas need to stand on their own merits. We wrote this book to help you make your ideas stick. By stick, we mean that your ideas are understood and remembered and have a lasting impact. They change your audience's opinions or behavior. At this point, it's worth asking why you'd need to make your ideas stick. After all, the vast majority of our daily communication doesn't require stickiness. Pass the gravy doesn't have to be memorable. When we tell our friends about our relationship problems, we're not trying to have a lasting impact. So not every idea is stick-worthy. When we ask people how often they need to make an idea stick, they tell us that the need arises between once a month and once a week, 12 to 52 times per year. For managers, these are big ideas about new strategic directions and guidelines for behavior. Teachers try to convey themes and conflicts and trends to their students, the kinds of themes and ways of thinking that will endure long after the individual factoids have faded. Columnists try to change readers' opinions on policy issues. Religious leaders try to share spiritual wisdom with their congregants. Nonprofit organizations try to persuade volunteers to contribute their time and donors to contribute their money to a worthy cause. Given the importance of making ideas stick, it's surprising how little attention is paid to the subject. When we get advice on communicating, it often concerns our delivery. Stand up straight, make eye contact, use appropriate hand gestures, practice, 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 but don't sound canned. Sometimes we get advice about structure. Tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them, then tell them what you told them. Or start by getting their attention. Tell a joke or a story. Another genre concerns knowing your audience. Know what your listeners care about so you can tailor your communication to them. And finally, there's the most common refrain in the realm of communication advice. Use repetition, repetition, repetition. All of this advice has obvious merit, except perhaps for the emphasis on repetition. If you have to tell someone the same thing 10 times, the idea probably wasn't very well designed. No urban legend has to be repeated 10 times. But this set of advice has one glaring shortcoming. It doesn't help Art Silverman as he tries to figure out the best way to explain that movie popcorn is really unhealthful. Silverman no doubt knows that he should make eye contact and practice. But what message is he supposed to practice? He knows his audience. They're people who like popcorn and don't realize how unhealthy it is. So what message does he share with them? Complicating matters, Silverman knew that he wouldn't have the luxury of repetition. He only had one shot to make the media care about his story. Or think about an elementary school teacher. She knows her goal, to teach the material mandated by the state curriculum committee. She knows her audience, third graders with a range of knowledge and skills. She knows how to speak effectively. She's a virtuoso, a posture and diction and eye contact. So the goal is clear, the audience is clear, and the format is clear. But the design of the message itself is far from clear. The biology students need to understand mitosis. Okay, now what? There are an infinite number of ways to teach mitosis. Which way will stick? And how do you know in advance? What led to Made to Stick? The broad question, then, is how do you design an idea that sticks? A few years ago, the two of us, brothers Chip and Dan, realized that both of us had been studying how ideas stick for about 10 years. Our expertise came from very different fields, but we had zeroed in on the same question. Why do some ideas succeed while others fail? Dan had developed a passion for education. He co-founded a startup publishing company called Thinkwell that asked a somewhat heretical question. If you were going to build a textbook from scratch, using video and technology instead of text, how would you do it? As the editor-in-chief of Thinkwell, Dan had to work with his team to determine the best ways to teach subjects like economics, biology, calculus, and physics. He had an opportunity to work with some of the most effective and best-loved professors in the country. The calculus teacher, who was also a stand-up comic. The biology teacher, who was named National Teacher of the Year. The economics teacher, who was also a chaplain and a playwright. Essentially, Dan enjoyed a crash course in what makes great teachers great. And he found that, while each teacher had a unique style, collectively, their instructional methodologies were almost identical. Chip, as a professor at Stanford University, had spent about 10 years asking why bad ideas sometimes won out in the social marketplace of ideas. How could a false idea displace a true one? And what made some ideas more viral than others? As an entry point into these topics, he dove into the realm of naturally sticky ideas such as urban legends and conspiracy theories. Over the years, he's become uncomfortably familiar with some of the most repulsive and absurd tales in the annals of ideas. He's heard them all. Here's a very small sampler. The Kentucky Fried Rat. Really, any tale that involves rats and fast food is on fertile ground. Coca-Cola rots your bones. This fear is big in Japan, but so far the country hasn't experienced an epidemic of gelatinous teenagers. If you flash your brights at a car whose headlights are off, you will be shot by a gang member. The Great Wall of China is the only man-made object that is visible from space. The wall is really long, but not very wide. Think about it. If the wall were visible, then any interstate highway would also be visible, and maybe a few Walmart superstores as well. You use only 10% of your brain. If this were true, it would certainly make brain damage a lot less worrisome. Chip, along with his students, has spent hundreds of hours collecting, coding, and analyzing naturally sticky ideas, urban legends, wartime rumors, proverbs, conspiracy theories, and jokes. Urban legends are false, but many naturally sticky ideas are true. In fact, perhaps the oldest class of naturally sticky ideas is the proverb, a nugget of wisdom that often endures over centuries and across cultures. As an example, versions of the proverb, "Where there's smoke, there's fire," have appeared in more than 55 different languages. In studying naturally sticky ideas, both trivial and profound, Chip has conducted more than 40 experiments with more than 1,700 participants on topics such as why Nostradamus's prophecies are still read after 400 years, why chicken soup for the soul stories are inspirational, why ineffective folk remedies persist. A few years ago, he started teaching a course at Stanford called How to Make Ideas Stick. The premise of the course was that if we understood what made ideas naturally sticky, we might be better at making our own messages stick. During the past few years, he has taught this topic to a few hundred students bound for careers as managers, public policy analysts, journalists, designers, and film directors. To complete the story of the brothers Heath, in 2004 it dawned on us that we had been approaching the same problem from different angles. Chip had researched and taught what made ideas stick. Dan had tried to figure out pragmatic ways to make ideas stick. Chip had compared the success of different urban legends and stories. Dan had compared the success of different math and government lessons. Chip was the researcher and the teacher. Dan was the practitioner and the writer. and we knew that we could make our parents happy by spending more quality time together. We wanted to take apart sticky ideas, both natural and created, and figure out what made them stick. What makes urban legends so compelling? Why do some chemistry lessons work better than others? Why does virtually every society circulate a set of proverbs? Why do some political ideas circulate widely while others fall short? In short, we were looking to understand what sticks. We adopted the "what sticks" terminology from one of our favorite authors, Malcolm Gladwell. In 2000, Gladwell wrote a brilliant book called The Tipping Point, which examined the forces that cause social phenomena to tip, or make the leap from small groups to big groups, the way contagious diseases spread rapidly once they infect a certain critical mass of people. Why did hush puppies experience a rebirth? Why did crime rates abruptly plummet in New York City? Why did the book Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood catch on? The Tipping Point has three sections. The first addresses the need to get the right people, and the third addresses the need for the right context. The middle section of the book, the stickiness factor, argues that the innovations are more likely to tip when they're sticky. When The Tipping Point was published, Chip realized that stickiness was the perfect word for the attribute that he was chasing with his research into the marketplace of ideas. This book is a complement to The Tipping Point, in the sense that we will identify the traits that make ideas sticky, a subject that was beyond the scope of Gladwell's book. Gladwell was interested in what makes social epidemics epidemic. Our interest is in how effective ideas are constructed, what makes some ideas stick and others disappear. So while our focus will veer away from The Tipping Point's turf, we want to pay tribute to Gladwell for the word stickiness. It stuck. Who spoiled Halloween? In the 1960s and 1970s, the tradition of Halloween trick-or-treating came under attack. Rumors circulated about Halloween sadists who put razor blades in apples and booby-trapped pieces of candy. The rumors affected the Halloween tradition nationwide. Parents carefully examined their children's candy bags. Schools opened their doors at night so the kids could trick-or-treat in a safe environment. Hospitals volunteered to X-ray candy bags. In 1985, an ABC News poll showed that 60% of parents worried that their children might be victimized. To this day, many parents warn their children not to eat any snacks that aren't prepackaged. This is a sad story. A family holiday sullied by bad people who inexplicably wish to harm children. But in 1985, the story took a strange twist. Researchers discovered something shocking about the candy tampering epidemic. It was a myth. The researchers, sociologists Joel Best and Gerald Horiuchi, studied every reported Halloween incident since 1958. They found no instances where strangers caused children life-threatening harm on Halloween by tampering with their candy. Two children did die on Halloween, but their deaths weren't caused by strangers. A 5-year-old boy found his uncle's heroin stash and overdosed. His relatives initially tried to cover their tracks by sprinkling heroin on his candy. In another case, a father hoping to collect on an insurance settlement caused the death of his own son by contaminating his candy with cyanide. In other words, the best social science evidence reveals that taking candy from strangers is perfectly okay. It's your family you should worry about. The candy tampering story has changed the behavior of millions of parents over the past 30 years. Sadly, it has made neighbors suspicious of neighbors. It has even changed the laws of this country. Both California and New Jersey passed laws that carry special penalties for candy tamperers. Why was this idea so successful? 6 principles of sticky ideas. The Halloween candy story is, in a sense, the evil twin of the CSPI story. Both stories highlighted an unexpected danger in a common activity, eating Halloween candy and eating movie popcorn. Both stories call for simple action, examining your child's candy and avoiding movie popcorn. Both made use of vivid concrete images that cling easily to memory, an apple with a buried razor blade and a table full of greasy foods. And both stories tapped into emotion, fear in the case of Halloween candy and disgust in the case of movie popcorn. The kidney heist, too, shares many of these traits. A highly unexpected outcome. A guy who stops for a drink and ends up one kidney short of a pair. A lot of concrete details. The ice-filled bathtub. The weird tube protruding from the lower back. Emotion. Fear. Disgust. Suspicion. We begin to see the same themes, the same attributes reflected in a wide range of successful ideas. What we found, based on Chip's research, and by reviewing the research of dozens of folklorists, psychologists, educational researchers, political scientists, and proverb hunters, was that sticky ideas shared certain key traits. There is no formula for a sticky idea. We don't want to overstate the case. But sticky ideas do draw from a common set of traits, which make them more likely to succeed. It's like discussing the attributes of a great basketball player. You can be pretty sure that any great player has some subset of traits like height, speed, agility, power, and court sense. But you don't need all of these traits in order to be great. Some great guards are 5'10" and scrawny, and having all the traits doesn't guarantee greatness. No doubt there are plenty of slow, clumsy 7-footers. It's clear, though, that if you're on the neighborhood court, choosing your team from among strangers, you should probably take a gamble on the 7-foot dude. Ideas work in much the same way. One skill we can learn is the ability to spot ideas that have natural talent, like the 7-foot stranger. Later in the book, we'll discuss Subway's advertising campaign that focused on Jared, an obese college student who lost more than 200 pounds by eating Subway sandwiches every day. The campaign was a huge success, and it wasn't created by a Madison Avenue advertising agency. It started with a single store owner who had the good sense to spot an amazing story. But here's where our basketball analogy breaks down. In the world of ideas, we can genetically engineer our players. We can create ideas with an eye to maximizing their stickiness. As we pored over hundreds of sticky ideas, we saw over and over the same six principles at work. Principle 1. Simplicity. How do we find the essential core of our ideas? A successful defense lawyer says, if you argue 10 points, even if each is a good point, when they get back to the jury room, they won't remember any. To strip an idea down to its core, we must be masters of exclusion. We must relentlessly prioritize. Saying something short is not the mission. Sound bites are not the ideal. Proverbs are the ideal. We must create ideas that are both simple and profound. The golden rule is the ultimate model of simplicity. A one-sentence statement so profound that an individual could spend a lifetime learning to follow it. Principle 2. Unexpectedness. How do we get our audience to pay attention to our ideas, and how do we maintain their interest when we need time to get the ideas across? We need to violate people's expectations. We need to be counterintuitive. A bag of popcorn is as unhealthy as a whole day's worth of fatty foods. We can use surprise, an emotion whose function is to increase alertness and cause focus, to grab people's attention. But surprise doesn't last. For our idea to endure, we must generate interest and curiosity. How do you keep students engaged during the 48th history class of the year? We can engage people's curiosity over a long period of time by systematically opening gaps in their knowledge, and then filling those gaps. Principle 3. Concreteness. How do we make our ideas clear? We must explain our ideas in terms of human actions, in terms of sensory information. This is where so much business communication goes awry. Mission statements, synergies, strategies, visions. They are often ambiguous to the point of being meaningless. Naturally sticky ideas are full of concrete images. Ice-filled bathtubs, apples with razors. Because our brains are wired to remember concrete data. In Proverbs, abstract truths are often encoded in concrete language. A bird in hand is worth two in the bush. Speaking concretely is the only way to ensure that our idea will mean the same thing to everyone in our audience. Principle 4, Credibility. How do we make people believe our ideas? When the former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop talks about a public health issue, most people accept his ideas without skepticism. But in most day-to-day situations, we don't enjoy this authority. Sticky ideas have to carry their own credentials. We need ways to help people test our ideas for themselves, a try-before-you-buy philosophy for the world of ideas. When we're trying to build a case for something, most of us instinctively grasp for hard numbers, but in many cases, this is exactly the wrong approach. In the sole U.S. presidential debate in 1980 between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter, Reagan could have cited innumerable statistics demonstrating the sluggishness of the economy. Instead, he asked a simple question that allowed voters to test for themselves. Before you vote, ask yourself if you are better off today than you were 4 years ago. Principle 5, Emotions. How do we get people to care about our ideas? We make them feel something. In the case of movie popcorn, we make them feel disgusted by its unhealthiness. The statistic, 37 grams, doesn't elicit any emotions. Research shows that people are more likely to make a charitable gift to a single needy individual than to an entire impoverished region. We are wired to feel things for people, not for abstractions. Sometimes the hard part is finding the right emotion to harness. For instance, it's difficult to get teenagers to quit smoking by instilling in them a fear of the consequences, but it's easier to get them to quit by tapping into their resentment of the duplicity of big tobacco. Principle 6, Stories. How do we get people to act on our ideas? We tell stories. Firefighters naturally swap stories after every fire, and by doing so, they multiply their experience. After years of hearing stories, they have a richer, more complete mental catalog of critical situations they might confront during a fire and the appropriate responses to those situations. Research shows that mentally rehearsing a situation helps us perform better when we encounter that situation in the physical environment. Similarly, hearing stories acts as a kind of mental flight simulator, preparing us to respond more quickly and effectively. Those are the 6 principles of successful ideas. To summarize, here's our checklist for creating a successful idea. A simple, unexpected, concrete, credentialed, emotional story. A clever observer will note that this sentence can be compacted into the acronym SUCCESS. This is sheer coincidence, of course. Okay, we admit success is a little corny. We could have changed simple to core and reordered a few letters, but you have to admit, success is less memorable. No special expertise is needed to apply these principles. There are no licensed stickologists. Moreover, many of the principles have a common sense ring to them. Didn't most of us already have the intuition that we should be simple and use stories? It's not as though there's a powerful constituency for overcomplicated, lifeless prose. But wait a minute. We claim that using these principles is easy, and most of them do seem relatively commonsensical. So why aren't we deluged with brilliantly designed sticky ideas? Why is our life filled with more process memos than proverbs? Sadly, there is a villain in our story. The villain is a natural psychological tendency that consistently confounds our ability to create ideas using these principles. It's called the curse of knowledge. We will capitalize the phrase throughout the book to give it the drama we think it deserves. Tappers and Listeners. In 1990, Elizabeth Newton earned a PhD in psychology at Stanford by studying a simple game in which she assigned people to one of two roles. Tappers or listeners. Tappers received a list of 25 well-known songs, such as Happy Birthday to You and the Star-Spangled Banner. Each tapper was asked to pick a song and tap out the rhythm to a listener by knocking on a table. The listener's job was to guess the song based on the rhythm being tapped. By the way, this experiment is fun to try at home if there's a good listener candidate nearby. The listener's job in this game is quite difficult. Over the course of Newton's experiment, 120 songs were tapped out. Listeners guessed only 2.5% of the songs, 3 out of 120. But here's what made the result worthy of a dissertation in psychology. Before the listeners guessed the name of the song, Newton asked the tappers to predict the odds that the listeners would guess correctly. They predicted that the odds were 50%. The tappers got their message across one time in 40, but they thought they were getting their message across one time in 2. Why? When a tapper taps, she is hearing the song in her head. Go ahead and try it for yourself. Tap out the Star-Spangled Banner. It's impossible to avoid hearing the tune in your head. Meanwhile, the listeners can't hear that tune. All they can hear is a bunch of disconnected taps, like a kind of bizarre Morse code. In the experiment, tappers are flabbergasted at how hard the listeners seem to be working to pick up the tune. Isn't the song obvious? The tappers' expressions when a listener guesses "Happy Birthday to You" for the Star-Spangled Banner are priceless. How could you be so stupid? It's hard to be a tapper. The problem is that tappers have been given knowledge, the song title, that makes it impossible for them to imagine what it's like to lack that knowledge. When they're tapping, they can't imagine what it's like for the listeners to hear isolated taps rather than a song. This is the curse of knowledge. Once we know something, we find it hard to imagine what it was like not to know it. Our knowledge has cursed us. And it becomes difficult for us to share our knowledge with others because we can't readily recreate our listener's state of mind. The tapper-listener experiment is reenacted every day across the world. The tappers and listeners are CEOs and frontline employees, teachers and students, politicians and voters, marketers and customers, writers and readers. All of these groups rely on ongoing communication. But like the tappers and listeners, they suffer from enormous information imbalances. When a CEO discusses unlocking shareholder value, there is a tune playing in her head that the employees can't hear. It's a hard problem to avoid. A CEO might have 30 years of daily immersion in the logic and conventions of business. Reversing the process is as impossible as unringing a bell. You can't unlearn what you already know. There are, in fact, only two ways to beat the curse of knowledge reliably. The first is not to learn anything. The second is to take your ideas and transform them. This book will teach you how to transform your ideas to beat the curse of knowledge. The six principles presented earlier are your best weapons. They can be used as a kind of checklist. Let's take the CEO who announces to her staff that they must strive to maximize shareholder value. Is this idea simple? Yes, in the sense that it's short, but it lacks the useful simplicity of a proverb. Is it unexpected? No. Concrete? Not at all. Credible? Only in the sense that it's coming from the mouth of the CEO. Emotional? No. A story? No. Contrast the maximize shareholder value idea with John F. Kennedy's famous 1961 call to put a man on the moon and return him safely by the end of the decade. Simple? Yes. Unexpected? Yes. Concrete? Amazingly so. Credible? The goal seemed like science fiction, but the source was credible. Emotional? Yes. Story? In miniature. Had John F. Kennedy been a CEO, he would have said, "Our mission is to become the international leader in the space industry through maximum team-centered innovation and strategically targeted aerospace initiatives." Fortunately, JFK was more intuitive than a modern-day CEO. He knew that opaque, abstract missions don't captivate and inspire people. The moon mission was a classic case of a communicator's dodging the curse of knowledge. It was a brilliant and beautiful idea, a single idea, that motivated the actions of millions of people for a decade. Systematic creativity. Picture in your mind the type of person who's great at coming up with ideas. Have a mental image of that person? A lot of people, when asked to do this, describe a familiar stereotype. The creative genius, the kind of person who thinks up slogans in a hot advertising agency. Maybe, like us, you picture someone with gelled hair and hip clothing carrying a dog-eared notebook full of ironies and epiphanies, ready to drop everything and launch a 4-hour brainstorming session in a room full of caffeine and whiteboards. Or maybe your stereotype isn't quite so elaborate. There's no question that some people are more creative than others. Perhaps they're just born that way. So maybe you'll never be the Michael Jordan of sticky ideas. But the premise of this book is that creating sticky ideas is something that can be learned. In 1999, an Israeli research team assembled a group of 200 highly regarded ads, ads that were finalists and award winners in the top advertising competitions. They found that 89% of the award-winning ads could be classified into 6 basic categories or templates. That's remarkable. We might expect great creative concepts to be highly idiosyncratic, emerging from the whims of born creative types. It turns out that 6 simple templates go a long way. Most of these templates relate to the principle of unexpectedness. For example, the extreme consequences template points out unexpected consequences of a product attribute. One ad emphasizes the power of a car stereo system. When the stereo belts out a tune, a bridge starts oscillating to the music, and when the speakers are cranked up, the bridge shimmies so hard that it nearly collapses. This same template also describes the famous World War II slogan devised by the Ad Council, a nonprofit organization that creates public service campaigns for other nonprofits and government agencies. Loose lips sink ships. And speaking of extreme consequences, let's not forget the eggs sizzling in the 1980s commercial, "This is Your Brain on Drugs," also designed by the Ad Council. The template also pops up spontaneously in naturally sticky ideas. For example, the legend that Newton discovered gravity when an apple fell on his head. The researchers also tried to use their 6 templates to classify 200 other ads from the same publications and for the same types of products that had not received awards. Amazingly, when the researchers tried to classify these less successful ads, they could classify only 2% of them. The surprising lesson of this story: highly creative ads are more predictable than uncreative ones. It's like Tolstoy's quote, "All happy families resemble each other, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." All creative ads resemble one another, but each loser is uncreative in its own way. But if creative ads consistently make use of the same basic set of templates, perhaps creativity can be taught. Perhaps even novices with no creative experience could produce better ideas if they understood the templates. The Israeli researchers, curious about the ability to teach creativity, decided to see just how far a template could take someone. They brought in 3 groups of novices and gave each group some background information about 3 products: a shampoo, a diet food item, and a sneaker. One group received the background information on the products and immediately started generating ads with no training. An experienced creative director who didn't know how the group had been trained selected its top 15 ads. Then those ads were tested by consumers. The group's ads stood out. Consumers rated them as annoying. Could this be the long-awaited explanation for the ads of local car dealerships? A second group was trained for 2 hours by an experienced creativity instructor who showed the participants how to use a free association brainstorming method. This technique is a standard method for teaching creativity. It's supposed to broaden associations, spark unexpected connections, and get lots of creative ideas on the table so that people can select the very best. If you've ever sat in on a class on brainstorming great ideas, this method is probably the one you were taught. Again, the 15 best ads were selected by the same creative director who didn't know how the group had been trained, and the ads were then tested by consumers. This group's ads were rated as less annoying than those of the untrained group, but no more creative. The final group was trained for 2 hours on how to use the 6 creative templates. Once again, the 15 best ads were selected by the creative director and tested with consumers. Suddenly, these novices sprouted creativity. Their ads were rated as 50% more creative and produced a 55% more positive attitude toward the products advertised. This is a stunning improvement for a 2-hour investment in learning a few basic templates. It appears that there are indeed systematic ways to produce creative ideas. What this Israeli research team did for advertisements is what this book does for your ideas. We will give you suggestions for tailoring your ideas in a way that makes them more creative and more effective with your audience. We've created our checklist of 6 principles for precisely this purpose. But isn't the use of a template or a checklist confining? Surely we're not arguing that a color-by-numbers approach will yield more creative work than a blank canvas approach. Actually, yes. That's exactly what we're saying. If you want to spread your ideas to other people, you should work within the confines of the rules that have allowed other ideas to succeed over time. You want to invent new ideas, not new rules. This book can't offer a foolproof recipe. We'll admit it up front. We won't be able to show you how to get 12-year-olds to gossip about mitosis around the campfire. And in all likelihood, your process improvement memo will not circulate decades from now as a proverb in another culture. But we can promise you this. Regardless of your level of natural creativity, we will show you how a little focused effort can make almost any idea stickier. And a sticky idea is an idea that is more likely to make a difference. All you need to do is understand the 6 principles of powerful ideas. Chapter 1. Simple. Every move an army soldier makes is preceded by a staggering amount of planning, which can be traced to an original order from the President of the United States. The President orders the Joint Chiefs of Staff to accomplish an objective, and the Joint Chiefs set the parameters of the operation. Then the orders and plans begin to cascade downward, from generals to colonels to captains. The plans are quite thorough, specifying the scheme of maneuver and the concept of fires, what each unit will do, which equipment it will use, how it will replace munitions, and so on. The orders snowball until they accumulate enough specificity to guide the actions of individual foot soldiers at particular moments in time. The Army invests enormous energy in its planning, and its processes have been refined over many years. The system is a marvel of communication. There's just one drawback. The plans often turn out to be useless. The trite expression we always use is no plan survives contact with the enemy, says Colonel Tom Kolditz, the head of the Behavioral Sciences Division at West Point. You may start off trying to fight your plan, but the enemy gets a vote. Unpredictable things happen. The weather changes. A key asset is destroyed. The enemy responds in a way you don't expect. Many armies fail because they put all their emphasis into creating a plan that becomes useless 10 minutes into the battle. The Army's challenge is akin to writing instructions for a friend to play chess on your behalf. You know a lot about the rules of the game, and you may know a lot about your friend and the opponent. But if you try to write move-by-move instructions, you'll fail. You can't possibly foresee more than a few moves. The first time the opponent makes a surprise move, your friend will have to throw out your carefully designed plans and rely on her instincts. Colonel Kolditz says, "Over time, we've come to understand more and more about what makes people successful in complex operations." He believes that plans are useful in the sense that they are proof that planning has taken place. The planning process forces people to think through the right issues. But as for the plans themselves, Kolditz says, they just don't work on the battlefield. So, in the 1980s, the Army adapted its planning process, inventing a concept called Commander's Intent, CI. CI is a crisp, plain-talk statement that appears at the top of every order, specifying the plan's goal, the desired end state of an operation. At high levels of the Army, the CI may be relatively abstract. Break the will of the enemy in the southeast region. At the tactical level, for colonels and captains, it is much more concrete. My intent is to have 3rd Battalion on Hill 4305, to have the hill cleared of enemy. with only ineffective remnants remaining, so we can protect the flank of 3rd Brigade as they pass through the lines. The CI never specifies so much detail that it risks being rendered obsolete by unpredictable events. You can lose the ability to execute the original plan, but you never lose the responsibility of executing the intent, says Kolditz. In other words, if there's one soldier left in the 3rd Battalion on Hill 4305, he'd better be doing something to protect the flank of the 3rd Brigade. Commander's intent manages to align the behavior of soldiers at all levels without requiring play-by-play instructions from their leaders. When people know the desired destination, they're free to improvise as needed in arriving there. Colonel Kolditz gives an example. Suppose I'm commanding an artillery battalion and I say, we're going to pass this infantry unit through our lines forward. That means something different to different groups. The mechanics know that they'll need lots of repair support along the roads because if a tank breaks down on a bridge, the whole operation will come to a screeching halt. The artillery knows they'll need to fire smoke or have engineers generate smoke in the breach area where the infantry unit moves forward, so it won't get shot up as it passes through. As a commander, I could spend a lot of time enumerating every specific task, but as soon as people know what the intent is, they begin generating their own solutions. The Combat Maneuver Training Center, the unit in charge of military simulations, recommends that officers arrive at the commander's intent by asking themselves two questions. If we do nothing else during tomorrow's mission, we must... The single most important thing that we must do tomorrow is... No plan survives contact with the enemy. No doubt this principle has resonance for people who have no military experience whatsoever. No sales plan survives contact with a customer. No lesson plan survives contact with teenagers. It's hard to make ideas stick in a noisy, unpredictable, chaotic environment. If we're to succeed, the first step is this. Be simple. Not simple in terms of dumbing down or sound bites. You don't have to speak in monosyllables to be simple. What we mean by simple is finding the core of the idea. Finding the core means stripping an idea down to its most critical essence. To get to the core, we've got to weed out superfluous and tangential elements. But that's the easy part. The hard part is weeding out ideas that may be really important, but just aren't the most important idea. The Army's commander's intent forces its officers to highlight the most important goal of an operation. The value of the intent comes from its singularity. You can't have 5 North Stars. You can't have 5 most important goals. And you can't have 5 commander's intents. Finding the core is analogous to writing the commander's intent. It's about discarding a lot of great insights in order to let the most important insight shine. The French aviator and author, Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, once offered a definition of engineering elegance. A designer knows he has achieved perfection not when there is nothing left to add, but when there is nothing left to take away. A designer of simple ideas should aspire to the same goal, knowing how much can be wrung out of an idea before it begins to lose its essence. In fact, we'll follow our own advice and strip this book down to its core. Here it is. There are 2 steps in making your ideas sticky. Step 1 is to find the core. And step 2 is to translate the core using the success checklist. That's it. We'll spend the next half chapter on step 1 and the remainder of the book on step 2. The first step in unpacking these ideas is to explore why Southwest Airlines deliberately ignores the food preferences of its customers. Finding the core at Southwest Airlines. It's common knowledge that Southwest is a successful company, but there is a shocking performance gap between Southwest and its competitors. Although the airlines industry as a whole has only a passing acquaintance with profitability, Southwest has been consistently profitable for more than 30 years. The reasons for Southwest's success could and do fill up books, but perhaps the single greatest factor in the company's success is its dogged focus on reducing costs. Every airline would like to reduce costs, but Southwest has been doing it for decades. For this effort to succeed, the company must coordinate thousands of employees, ranging from marketers to baggage handlers. Southwest has a commander's intent, a core, that helps people guide this coordination. As related by James Carville and Paul Vegala, Herb Kelleher, the longest-serving CEO of Southwest, once told someone, "I can teach you the secret to running this airline in 30 seconds. This is it. We are the low-fare airline. Once you understand that fact, you can make any decision about this company's future as well as I can." "Here's an example," he said. Tracy from marketing comes into your office. She says her surveys indicate that the passengers might enjoy a light entree on the Houston to Las Vegas flight. All we offer is peanuts, and she thinks a nice chicken Caesar salad would be popular. What do you say? The person stammered for a moment, so Kelleher responded, "You say, Tracy, will adding that chicken Caesar salad make us the low-fare airline from Houston to Las Vegas? Because if it doesn't help us become the unchallenged low-fare airline, we're not serving any damn chicken salad." Kelleher's commander's intent is, "We are the low-fare airline." This is a simple idea, but it is sufficiently useful that it has guided the actions of Southwest's employees for more than 30 years. Now, this core idea, the low-fare airline, isn't the whole story, of course. For instance, in 1996, Southwest received 124,000 applications for 5,444 openings. It's known as a great place to work, which is surprising. It's not supposed to be fun to work for penny pinchers. It's hard to imagine Walmart employees giggling their way through the workday. Yet somehow, Southwest has pulled it off. Let's think about the ideas driving Southwest Airlines as concentric circles. The central circle, the core, is the low-fare airline. But the very next circle might be, have fun at work. Southwest's employees know that it's okay to have fun so long as it doesn't jeopardize the company's status as the low-fare airline. A new employee can easily put these ideas together to realize how to act in unscripted situations. For instance, is it all right to joke about a flight attendant's birthday over the PA? Sure. Is it equally okay to throw confetti in her honor? Probably not. The confetti would create extra work for cleanup crews, and extra cleanup time means higher fares. It's the lighthearted business equivalent of the foot soldier who improvises based on the commander's intent. A well-thought-out simple idea can be amazingly powerful in shaping behavior. A warning. In the future, months after you've put down this book, you're going to recall the word simple as an element of the success checklist, and your mental thesaurus will faithfully go digging for the meaning of simple. And it's going to come back with associations like dumbing down, shooting for the lowest common denominator, making things easy, and so on. At that moment, you've got to remind your thesaurus of the examples we've explored. The low-fare airline. And the other stories in this chapter aren't simple because they're full of easy words. They're simple because they reflect the commander's intent. It's about elegance and prioritization, not dumbing down. Burying the lead. News reporters are taught to start their stories with the most important information. The first sentence, called the lead, contains the most essential elements of the story. A good lead can convey a lot of information, as in these two leads from the articles that won awards from the American Society of Newspaper Editors. A healthy 17-year-old heart pumped the gift of life through 34-year-old Bruce Murray Friday, following a 4-hour transplant operation that doctors said went without a hitch. Jerusalem, November 4th. A right-wing Jewish extremist shot and killed Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin tonight as he departed a peace rally attended by more than 100,000 in Tel Aviv, throwing Israel's government and the Middle East peace process into turmoil. After the lead, information is presented in decreasing order of importance. Journalists call this the inverted pyramid structure. The most important info, the widest part of the pyramid, is at the top. The inverted pyramid is great for readers. No matter what the reader's attention span, whether she reads only the lead or the entire story, the inverted pyramid maximizes the information she gleans.